So, what's in your glass? If you're like more and more Americans, it's not whiskey or rye or wine or a pale ale or lager. It'll be vodka. Ever since James Bond asked for a vodka martini, the clear spirit has gone from strength to strength, and it has risen exponentially. It's also reached something of a zenith in Las Vegas with the four-figure bottle service for Grey Goose that's now such a moneymaker at nightclubs along the Strip. This vodka boom is the subject of a new book by Victorino Mattis. It's called Vodka, How a Colorless, Odorless, Flavorless Spirit Conquered America. Vic Mattis joins us now. Vic, welcome to KNPR.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So we should probably assume that you've got a personal interest in the subject. I'm assuming vodka is your drink.
Actually, not really. I've always had vodka club soda from time to time, especially in the summer. But I love to explore other spirits, and I find it's more interesting, for example, scotch, whiskey, bourbon, rum. But what really happened, Dave, was I just started to know more and more people who seemed to drop what they were doing and get into the vodka business. So, for example, a buddy of mine decided to invest a serious chunk of change in a friend's startup vodka distillery in New Jersey, which I thought was a pretty big deal. At which point I thought, well, what is going on here? So I turned to the Distilled Spirits Council, the liquor lobby in town, and they gave me all the stats. And that's when I, you know, sort of realized how much Americans spend on vodka every year and how much we drink, considering it's flavorless, odorless, and colorless.
Now, remind us of how vodka is made.
The funny thing is, Dave, I had a conversation about this with an ad executive on Madison Avenue, and he told me, and he represents a vodka company, and he said, you know, essentially, you can distill vodka from anything. You could distill vodka from the chair I was sitting in. So as long as you take any spirit, any substance, and you distill it up to 190 proof, and then you bring it down, you water it down to about 80 proof, which would be about 40% alcohol, then presto, you have vodka. And the reason why you bring it up to such a high proof is you strip it of all its various impurities, but also it results in the stripping of any flavor, color, odor, or character. And when that happens, you have vodka. And that goes back to a 1949 definition of what vodka is.
So back, I guess, to the beginning of this craze, at least in this country, when was vodka first imported in significant amounts once Prohibition ended in the early 30s?
Well, that's right. Vodka first officially came onto the scene in 1934. So 80 years ago, the first vodka distillery was opened in the United States. It was in Bethel, Connecticut, and it was Smirnoff. So Americans have never had Smirnoff that was made in Russia. That's the interesting thing. The Smirnoff that we've always had was made in this country. For example, even today, there's a very large facility in Plainfield, Illinois. That first year that Smirnoff was in operation, they sold a mere 2,100 cases. It's not very much, considering today Smirnoff cranks out something like 20 million cases. So they struggled for the first few years in the 1930s. And then a couple of, you know, really interesting cocktails caught on. They were very trendy at the time, and they have survived to this day. One of them is the Bloody Mary, and that started in the 1930s, and that started at the St. Regis Hotel, the King Cole Bar in New York City, and that, of course, is vodka tomato juice. In the 1940s, you had the Moscow Mule, and that was created in Los Angeles, in fact, and that is vodka, ginger beer, lime. That became very popular in Hollywood, for instance. I think they supposedly say that a lot of actors like to drink it because they could drink it on the set and the directors would never find out because, you know, it leaves you breathless. And that became Smirnoff's tagline. It was vodka, Smirnoff leaves you breathless. And that was one of its attributes. And some people prefer that. The 1960s, you had James Bond drinking his vodka martini, shaken, not stirred. And by 1976, it overtakes the brown spirits, bourbon, whiskey, rum. The spirits that we had loved for 200 years had suddenly been displaced. And today, of course, it's a multi-billion industry.
So then we jump into the 1970s. Vodka really took off at that point with the arrival of a Russian brand, Stoli. Tell us a little bit about Stoli. What was unusual about the brand?
Well, you know, it's funny because, again, as I had mentioned, Americans weren't actually drinking, you know, vodka that was made in Russia for the early years. And then Finlandia came into the country around that same time, which is from Finland, obviously. But then, you know, the head of Pepsi-Cola had a meeting with President Nixon, and they decided that he would go over, the president of Pepsi-Cola would go over to the Soviet Union and offer them a deal. And the deal was, if they can provide Pepsi to the Soviets for the first time, then the Soviets would agree to allow Pepsi to handle distribution of an actual Russian-made vodka, and that was, of course, Stolichnaya. And that was the swap. And so Stoli came onto the scene in the late 60s and the early 70s, and that became enormously popular. The quality of it, I mean, that's some people like it and some people don't. But that happened in the 1970s at a time when there were, you know, very few imported vodkas. Most of the vodkas were made in the United States, and they were not of good quality. And then that began to change in the late 70s when finally the vodka from Sweden that we all know came onto the scene, and that was Absolut.
We're talking with Victorino Mattis. His new book is Vodka, How a Colorless, Odorless, Flavorless Spirit Conquered America. We've got a link to it at knprnews.org. So, Absolut, how did they rise to the top in this country?
Well, it's really an amazing story. It's quite a bit of a miracle, in fact, Dave, because they almost didn't happen in this country. You know, the Swedes sort of looked down on the vodka. They didn't like the idea, and they have a very low opinion of alcohol in Sweden. But they decided that they could export a vodka and make some money, and it would go into the welfare state over back in Sweden. So they thought that that would work out well, and it did. And when they brought it to the United States, most of the major distributors turned it down. They didn't like the idea of a vodka that was from Sweden, because in their minds, vodka comes from Russia. And in fact, they didn't like the name Absolut. Believe it or not, they almost called it Damn Swede Vodka. And they were going to have a picture of a Viking and beautiful women painted on the glass holding martinis. I mean, it was going to be a nightmare. But they held firm. And thank goodness, a very small importing company at the time called Carillon Importers, they decided, you know, what the heck, we'll give this a try. We'll take you on as a client. Carillon's big moneymaker at the time, by the way, was Grand Marnier, which is the orange liqueur. And Absolut was this tiny little client of theirs. And then they got themselves a very good advertising agency, which is called TBWA. And those were the guys who came up with this brilliant ad campaign. And it was just going to be simple, less is more. And they were going to have the image of the bottle, and it was going to say Absolut clarity, absolute perfection, just one little descriptive, but they would make it tongue in cheek. So they would say absolute perfection, but they'd put a little halo on top of the bottle, you know, so it's sort of making fun of themselves a little bit. And that, of course, became one of the most iconic campaigns in the history of advertising.
I'd mentioned at the beginning in introducing you, Grey Goose. Tell us a little bit about Grey Goose. It's a brand people are willing to spend a lot of money on, as you know, long say as it comes with a table at a really posh nightclub.
Oh, my goodness, that's absolutely right. In fact, I visited the distributing warehouse for Grey Goose in Las Vegas, which is a Southern Wine and Company. And the person who was giving me the tour said, without a doubt, that Grey Goose is Las Vegas's most popular vodka. It's amazing because, you know, at the time Grey Goose came out, Absolut was the big deal. You know, they're the ones who created the idea of a luxury, an affordable luxury, turning vodka into a status symbol, asking for vodkas by name. We just didn't say vodka tonic anymore or vodka club soda. We were saying, you know, please give me an Absolut and tonic, Absolut and soda. And then Sidney Frank, who was this entrepreneur from New Rochelle, one day in 1995 or 1996, he woke up and he said he had a vision, and the vision was for a vodka, and he was going to call it Grey Goose, and it was going to come from France, because he thought everything good comes from France, and it's going to be distilled from the finest wheat, the kind of wheat that's used in those delicate pastries, and it's going to come in a frosted bottle with a tall neck, and it's going to be filtered over champagne limestone, whatever that means. And and he knew that he thought, you know, Absolut was going for about $16 at the time, which was the most expensive vodka. And he thought, if he doubled the price to about $30, if he doubles the price, people are going to think it's twice as good. And he was right. He took a gamble, and people loved it. People loved the idea that I'm going to buy, you know, what, again, I mentioned is an affordable luxury, because movie stars could be getting Grey Goose, and billionaires could be getting Grey Goose, and you too could be getting Grey Goose. So you might not be driving a Bentley. You don't have your own Learjet, but you may be able to afford the same luxury, the same vodka that these other people could have. And Grey Goose really captured that.
So when you came out here and looked around, what did you make of what you saw? The sky-high prices people are willing to pay for a bottle of liquor that was probably manufactured and delivered to the club for a much, much smaller wholesale price.
It was really interesting, the nightclub and bar show in Las Vegas. It brings together sort of these purveyors. You have on the one hand the distillers, and you have, on the other hand, the people who run restaurants and bars, and they're trying to attract these people to please carry my vodka in your bar. And what you saw was all sorts of vodkas. I would say I saw the good, the bad, and the ugly. And in terms of, I won't give names, but there was one bottle, you know, that its only attraction was it had an LED light on the bottom of the bottle. So that if, you know, their idea was, it was out of New York, and their idea was, if you can't tell what's going on in a bar, it's dark, maybe you'll go for the bottle that's blinking. I mean, that's a horrible idea. I tried a vodka at the convention that was distilled from cactus, you know, and there was one bottle that was shaped like a lightning bolt because the lady said to me, you know, all these bottles are so boring and, you know, you need to have something that's really, you know, going to catch your eye. And of course, my thought was, you know, how does it taste? You know, that's really more important. But that was the scene. And then, of course, there was a big event at the Bellagio and I had gone over there. And yes, as you mentioned, they had bottle service. People used to scoff. I'd say about 10, 11 years ago, and I mentioned this in the book about when bottle service first came onto the scene in New York City, and people were really upset because not only did it take away the idea of finding, you know, this sort of very selective, trendy crowd, all you had to do was, you know, take out your credit card, but people were willing to spend $400 for a bottle of vodka, and you sit around. Today, for example, when I was in Las Vegas, I was offered a bottle for a table for $5,000.
Oh, man. Yeah.
But the good thing, Dave, is that you have unlimited club soda and lime and ice, all the ice you can want for that. You know, it's great. It's great. It's a great deal. It's rather insane, the reasoning, but it actually works. It's frightening how the logic works. And the logic behind bottle service is this. If you go to a fancy club, especially in Vegas, you know, you're maybe spending $15 to $20 per drink. Now, how many drinks can you get out of a bottle? You add it up. Yeah, it comes to $400 or $500 now more. And so that was their reasoning, and that's why they charge that. And so, you know, $5,000 for a table for, you know, the next 3 hours. And usually, as a fellow conventioneer told me, the people who show up for bottle service at 1 a.m. are so drunk they can't actually drink it. But, you know, they feel emboldened to go that route. And that's the state of the world we live in right now.
As you point out in your subtitle, by definition, vodka is a colorless, odorless, flavorless spirit. And that helped to get it started, I guess, particularly in the 1970s and beyond as a drink because it could be added to anything, juice flavored. It could leave a sweet taste. One of your sources said it's the spirit that can be candy coated. How important was that factor in vodka's rise?
It was extremely important because, for example, take the Bloody Mary, you know, it's a wonderful drink. Do not mix bourbon and tomato juice together, you know, or rum. That would be a nightmare. But it certainly works with vodka. It's very mixable. Now, here's the interesting thing. When Prohibition ended, people at the bars, the seasoned veterans, let's say, they were saying at the time that the new crowd that was coming in, the young crowd, the kids that were coming into the bar 18 years and older, it was a different crowd. These were kids who, when Prohibition started, were 4 years old. So they have no drinking experience. There's no speakeasy experience. That, you know, it just came out at the time and they wanted to get to that place. They wanted to feel that buzz. They were really excited about, you know, alcohol. And so the idea, and other drinks writers have talked about this, the idea of appreciating a fine scotch, the peatiness and the smokiness of a drink, you know, that became an obstacle. I don't need to appreciate this character. I just need something that's really mixable in juice. I don't want to have to taste it. And so in fact, you know, vodka appeals to, even to this day, a lot of Americans who don't like to taste booze in their booze. And there's nothing wrong with that. Everybody's different. You know, not everybody likes to, you know, appreciate scotch or a single malt. Certainly, I have my reservations with tequila. But certainly with vodka, you know, that is very mixable. And there are just a lot of people who like that. And so that changed after 1934. So as you were asking, it was a very important factor. But it is funny because when you think about the definition of vodka from 1949 being flavorless, odorless, colorless, you know, you still have over 1,000 brands. So how is this possible? There is a little wiggle room in the definition where you can add other additives. But by and large, aside from these little additives, which we're talking about parts per million, the rest of it has got to be marketing.
Vic Mattis, thanks so much for joining us. Great talking with you.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Victorino Mattis is the author of Vodka, How a Colorless, Odorless, Flavorless Spirit Conquered America. And we've got a link to the book at our website, knprnews.org.